Hello and welcome. It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, the host of the show. And we are once again, as always, reminding you that if you have a financial question for Bruce, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that is 1-888-6-ADVICE. You can always email questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com or text our studio line right now at 651-461-9226. Here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, Bruce Helmer. How are you, my friend?
Hello, Susie Jones. I am well. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm well. I was just telling the guys I have a little bit of allergies, and so I'm a little scratchy, but that's all right. I'll get through it.
You know, and I think today, and I didn't hear all the forecasts. I know the weather here in Minnesota, where we are, is going to be good.
Yes.
But the sky kind of has that that look about it that I wonder if we're not getting some smoke from the wildfires again, and maybe that's part of your scratchy, because it looks kind of dingy out, and I feel it a little bit, I think. But
all right. Well,
hey, I want to say something publicly.
Okay.
You are such listeners should know this about you. You are such a nice person. People that like to listen to you. I'm sure part of the reason is because your genuine niceness and good personness comes out, and I've known you for a lot of years.
Yeah.
You're one of the nice people that you meet in this world.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. My kids would probably disagree, but no. I'm teasing.
Well.
No, but I've been here almost 30 years, Bruce. It's hard to believe it's coming up on that, and I've loved every minute of being here. So thank you for letting me be a part of your show as well on Sunday mornings.
Well, you must have started at what, 14, 15, something like that?
Sure. So, we'll say that.
Hey, today I want to talk a little bit about the topic, and the outline is actually just taken directly from my last book that I wrote in 2013, and I can't believe it's been that long. I feel like I just did it. But the book is called Real Wealth, How to Make Smart Money Choices for What Matters Most to You. And today I'm going to talk about the five things that we can do with money. I think people think, you know, there's an infinite number of things that we can do with money, but if you think about it and boil it down, there's really only five different things that we can do. But also, one of the themes of the book, and one of the themes of this program, and one of the themes of our firm, our practice, and the financial planning and advising that we do with our clients, is that real wealth is not just financial. It's about leading an enriched life based on what's important to you, to your core values. Money's a tool that maybe that we can use to enhance our lives, whatever that means to us. But very rarely, if ever, do I encounter a person whose goal is just to accumulate as much money as they can. It's really about accumulating money so they can help kids or help grandkids or tithe to their church or retire with a comfortable lifestyle, with whatever comfortable might mean to them. Maybe the ability to have a second home or a vacation home on the shore of a lake in northern Minnesota or northern Wisconsin, or maybe it's a snowbird home or property. But whatever is important to you, we always start with that. What's important to you? What do you want? When do you want it? And is it reasonable? If somebody wants something that financially is probably not feasible for them, it's my job to tell them, well, I understand that you want to retire with $10 million and no debt and three homes, but I don't think we're going to be able to get there unless you win the lottery or something. So real wealth, what does it mean? It means different things to different people, and money, finances are part of it. So I mentioned that there's really only five things that you can do with money, and people might be listening going, what are you talking about? There's hundreds, there's thousands of things I can do with money. But at the end of the day, it comes down to I can spend it, I can save it, I can invest it, and I'm going to draw a distinction between saving and investing here before we're done. I can pay taxes with it, or I can give it away. And the financial planning that we do, and again, it starts with what do you want, when do you want it, what are your core values, what's important to you. The goal of the objective of financial planning is to increase your control on the size of each of those five things, those five slices. If you want to give away more, It's our job to help you determine how to do that and how to efficiently and effectively do that. If you're spending too much, it's our job to tell you that maybe you're spending beyond your means and we need to spend less. So let's start with that. So five things you can do. Number one is spend it. And boy, Americans like to spend it. You know, most people don't have a problem spending money. In fact, most people have the opposite problem. Maybe they spend too much money. So when you look at spending, and it's one of the exercises that we do with a lot of our clients, Susie, we try to determine where their money's going. And oftentimes people don't realize where they're spending money and how much they're spending. And I ask them, you know, either to use, you know, an online tool, or even if it's just an old-fashioned write down everything or keep your receipts. But for a couple months, track your spending and see where it goes and see where, if you know, because I've had people tell me before, I would love to invest money with you, but I don't have any extra money. I need everything that my paycheck just to live. And in some cases, I understand that that is absolutely true, and I never want to be insensitive to that. But in some cases, it's really not true. If we can find ways to reduce spending, then we capture some money that can be used for investing and a brighter future and a happier retirement. So first thing I ask people to do, you know, in addition to just tracking where it's going, then determine on the money you're spending, is that a necessity or is that a luxury? And I'm certainly not opposed to having some fun along the way. It's okay to spend money on luxurious things as long as it doesn't preclude you from saving and investing and putting money away for your future. So, you know, what's a luxury? What's a necessity? Well, most of us need a car in this world to be able to get to where we need to go, to get to work and to get groceries and so forth. But is it a car that's a necessity? Is it a car that maybe costs $20,000? Or did you have to have a car that costs $60,000? And wouldn't the $20,000 car get you where you want to go just as effectively? Now, again, I'm not against somebody buying a $60,000 car or a $100,000 car if they can afford to do that, and that's a priority to them. To a lot of people, having a luxurious car is not a priority. Just having something to get them where they need to go is all they want and all they need, and they're happy with that. So food and drink, a lot of us buy coffee at the coffee places, the Starbucks of this world or the Caribou's or whatever it is. Could you make coffee at home that's just as good, a lot cheaper? A lot of people have memberships to health clubs, and they don't go to the health club anymore. A lot of people subscribe to some sort of cable TV service and they never watch anything on it. So look at your spending. What is there places that you can logically cut and recapture some assets coming back to you that are going out the door now and something that you really don't need, really aren't using, and it's just frivolous spending? Because if we can give that money back to you, then that's an opportunity to maybe invest that money for your future. And I'm going to talk about a concept here before we're done called opportunity cost as well, but I'll get there in a minute. So number one, spending. We can spend it. Let's spend smart. Let's spend efficiently. Let's not spend more than we can afford to spend. And that's a big problem in this country. You know, a lot of people are carrying credit card debt and high interest, non-deductible debt because they bought something that they really didn't have the economic wherewithal to buy. They couldn't afford it. They overspent. So that's one of the things we do. Now, again, I don't want to tell somebody how they have to spend their money or what they can and cannot buy. But I do tell them that that if you look at what you're actually spending, most people will realize that they probably are putting money into something that they really don't want and they really don't need, and it's frivolous. So can we cut spending? Number two, the second thing we can do with money, we can save it. Now, I differentiate saving from investing in that with saving, it's probably rainy day money. It's emergency money. It's money available in a bank with no risk of principal. I get the highest interest rate that I can. If I have something come up, I need a car repair. I need a home repair. Something happens. I've got this money for short-term needs for life. And again, statistics show that most people, and probably a lot of people listening right now, if something happened to your car and you needed $1,000 for a car repair, or you needed $1,000 for your home and air conditioner at home, they don't have it in the bank, and they end up putting it on a credit card. And then when the invoice comes, they can't pay the balance, and now they're paying interest on getting something that they literally had to have. This is a necessity. This is not luxury. This is necessity. So people need to build up what I call their safe money, their rainy day money, their emergency money. And I always recommend people have at least 3 months' living expenses sitting safely in a bank or financial institution with no risk of principal. So that's the second thing we can do with money. We can spend it, we can save it, or we can invest it. Now, let's differentiate what the difference between investing and saving. Investing is probably something that we're going to have market exposure, not just stocks, but we might also have bonds, we might have real estate, we might have gold and silver and other precious metals. We're trying to enhance our return on investment beyond what we can get with just a regular savings account for our rainy day or our safe money. When we invest, a common way for a lot of our listeners to do it, and you as well, Susie, is company retirement plan, whether it's a 401k plan or a 403b, 457 plan. You might be putting money into a company plan. They just withhold it from your paycheck. And oftentimes, they will give you a matching contribution for participating in that plan. There also might be a tax deduction that goes along with that contribution, meaning the money that you contribute to the plan is deducted from your income the year that you make that contribution, and it reduces your tax liability. So a lot of listeners are participating in that, but it might be other things as well. It might be investing just outside of your company retirement plan in a traditional IRA, or in a Roth IRA, or maybe it's just a non-retirement plan type of an account, what we often call a brokerage account or a money-managed account. And these types of investments, again, should get you higher returns than you can get on a regular savings account, but there's also an element of risk on these plans. Most of our listeners have not forgotten 2008, and to a lesser extent, 2022, years where the stock market went down, and maybe some of these other asset classes went down as well. And you might have seen some retraction on your retirement plan or your investment. So these are things, these investing money, participating in the stock market, this is long-term money. And Peg and I talk about this a lot almost every week. We talk about long-term, short-term, and mid-term money. And in investments in stocks and in bonds and in real estate and precious metals and commodities, this is for your long-term money. So if I'm 50 years old and I'm not going to retire for at least 10, maybe 15 years, that money should be mostly in these investments like stocks. But if my time horizon is shorter, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago on the show, how do we reduce our risk as our time horizon shortens as we get closer to retirement and as we get closer to the day where we're actually going to spend this money or use our money for lifestyle to replace our paycheck? Then we want to get more conservative. So three things so far that we can do with money that I've talked about. We can spend it, we can save it, we can invest it, and we can pay taxes with it. And one of the goals and one of the biggest value adds that I can bring to my client, one of the best ways that we can enhance your ROI, your return on investment, is if we can find legitimate ways to reduce your tax liability. And again, we talk about this a lot on the show. And the thing with taxes, and I don't talk about this enough, Susie and listeners, the thing with taxes is there's no opportunity for you to do anything else with that money. And that may seem glaringly obvious, but anytime we have a cost in our financial world, like taxes, we not only have that cost, but we have the added cost of what we could have done with those same dollars if we didn't have that cost. Oh my, was that word salad? What did he just say? So what I mean is, let's say that I devise a strategy or I demonstrate a strategy to my client that's going to save them $1,000 in income taxes. Well, the client is probably grateful, and they're probably happy to have that $1,000 that was going to go to Uncle Sam, and now it doesn't have to go to Uncle Sam. But in addition, now that they have that $1,000, they have the opportunity to put that money somewhere where we can apply earnings. But if I give that money to Uncle Sam, if I pay taxes, I have the lost opportunity of not being able to earn interest or have earnings applied to that money. This is something the economists understand very well, that economics college students understand very well. But most financial advisors don't talk about it, but it's very real. So if I can recapture that $1,000, I demonstrate this strategy that saves my client $1,000 in taxes, they can now take that $1,000 and maybe go buy a 12-month CD and earn 5%. Well, at the end of the year, now they've got an extra $50. But if they had to give that money to Uncle Sam, they not only don't have the $1,000, they don't have the $50. That's the lost opportunity cost. So taxes are a big deal. If we can find a way to be more efficient and reduce tax liability and give that money back to you, because the greatest investment in the world, it doesn't matter what you earn, it matters what you get to keep. So minimizing or reducing taxes is always a big component of comprehensive financial planning. So I've talked about this a lot on the show over the years. When you invest or in your life, in your world, there's only three ways that your savings and investments can be taxed. Either fully and immediately taxable, meaning you get a 1099 on it every year. It's not in an IRA. It's not in a Roth IRA. It's just in an investment that applies earnings, and you get a 1099, and you pay taxes on those earnings. By the way, side note here, frequently I have clients complain to me about having to pay taxes, and I always tell them, look, you're right that we want to be smart and efficient and reduce taxes to the extent that we can, because that enhances your return on investment. It's what you get to keep that matters. But you know what? Sometimes we can't avoid taxes. And at the end of the day, it's a good thing, because I'd much rather you have a taxable event because you made money than you have a deduction because you lost money. Making money is a good thing, and if you make money, somehow you're going to end up having to pay taxes on it. So fully and immediately taxable, I get a 1099 on my earnings. Tax deferred or tax delayed is the second way investments can be treated from a tax standpoint. This is the traditional IRA, traditional 401k. I get a deduction for my contribution. I don't get any 1099s. I don't pay any taxes on the earnings until I actually take a withdrawal from the account. Then I pay the taxes. All things being equal, deferring or delaying the taxes are better than paying them right away. And then finally, the third way investments can be treated from a tax standpoint is tax advantaged, meaning maybe I don't pay any taxes at all. And the best example here is probably Roth IRA. I don't get a deduction for the contribution, but if I let that money accumulate until age 59 and a half or 5 years, whichever is longer, I can take withdrawals and I don't have to pay any taxes on the gain. All things being equal, avoiding the taxes altogether is better than just delaying them, but delaying them is better than paying them immediately. And when I talk to clients or I have public speaking engagements, listeners and Susie, I always tell people, all things being equal, but all things aren't equal. For example, on taxable investments, and everybody tries to avoid taxable investments because they don't want to pay taxes. And I just got done saying, hey, if we can reduce your taxes, there's an opportunity gain, and it's the best way to enhance return on investment. So we don't want to pay taxes. But sometimes you're better off paying a little bit of taxes now to avoid a lot of taxes later. So when we look at paying taxes and tax efficiency, we're not just looking at the current tax year, we're looking at taxes over a lifetime. And taxable accounts have certain advantages. I know people try to avoid them, but that money is generally liquid and you can use it if you need it, where tax deferred and tax advantaged accounts might tie your money up until you're 59 and a half years old. So there's an advantage to have some liquidity in terms of these taxable accounts. You might be able to be taxed at a lower rate called long-term capital gains instead of ordinary income tax. And taxable accounts, if I die with the money and I leave it to someone else, they get what's called a step-up in basis. So let's say I went out and bought a stock for $1 a share, and I hold it for a lot of years, and now it's trading at $100 a share. If I sold that stock, I've got to pay the taxes on that $99 a share gain. But if I die with that stock and I leave it to my kids, they inherit the basis where it's at now, $100. So if they sell that stock, they don't have any taxes because their basis steps up. So understanding tax efficiency is a really, really, really big deal. And then finally, and I know we're coming to the end of the first segment, Susie, the fifth thing we can do with money is give it away. Whether we're giving to charity, whether we're gifting to our kids, our loved ones, our church, again, there's efficient ways to give money away so you not only are generous or philanthropic, but you're also maybe doing things that benefit you financially. So there's smart ways to give money away. So those are the five things you can do. You can spend it, you can save it, you can invest it, you can pay taxes with it, and you can give it away. And anything you do in life is going to fit in one of those five categories. Susie?
All right, Bruce, very good. I was writing all that down, and we want to remind people that are listening right now, if they want to jump in at any point and ask Bruce a follow-up question on one of those five, it's 651-461-9226. You can also call that number. We'd love to have you a part of the show that way. The number to call if you want to talk to Bruce directly, 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. Welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones along with Bruce Helmer. We want to remind you at this point, this is your opportunity to jump in and be a part of the show at 651-461-9226. You can call that number, 651-461-9226, or you can text us a question at that line, 651-461-9226. Now, once again, founder of Wealth Enhancement Group, Bruce Helmer. Bruce, welcome back.
Thank you, Susie Jones. Thank you for hanging in there, listeners. And if you joined us late or you just joined us, the first half of the show, and Peg is taking by the way, if you're listening for Peg's voice, she's taking a well-deserved week off again this week. This is weird. Peg and I are kind of alternating weeks off here. It's been a few weeks since we've been here together, but I think next week we're back together as a team. But in the first half of the show, I talked about the five things that you can do with money. And a lot of people say there's more than five things. You can spend it. Now, you can spend it on a lot of different things, but you can spend it. That's number one. Number two, you can save it, your emergency money, your rainy day, safe money in the bank. Number three, you can invest it. This is usually longer-term money with exposure to investments like stocks that can potentially give you higher rewards, higher returns on investment, but they come with an element of risk, particularly potentially in the short term. And that's something I do want to talk about today. We'd be remiss after the week we just had in the market if I didn't at least mention that. So number one, spend it. Number two, save it. Number three, invest it. Number four, pay taxes with it. And number five, we can give it away. We can make charitable donations. We can gift to loved ones, help our kids, help our grandkids, our church, whatever. Those are the five things that we can do. Anything you can think of that you might do with your money probably fits into one of those five categories. So it was a tough week in the market, and I've already had more than one person say, I told you so, presidential election year, I knew this was going to happen, it's going to be horrible. And even with the retraction that we had in this last week, the market is still well up year to date. 2024 is in positive territory. Not as positive today as it was a week ago, but it's still well up. I don't think, personally, this is the beginning of another 2008 or even a 2022. Volatility in the market is not unexpected, and volatility is probably higher now than it's ever been, and there's a lot of reasons why that is true, but not because it's a presidential election year, in my opinion. Think about, just a kind of a basic one. Not so long ago, all trades on the market were made by professional traders on the floor of an exchange. Well, now, probably many of you listening to me make trades on your smartphone. You can make trades walking down the street or sitting, in your kitchen on your phone. That technology didn't exist not very many years ago. So with all these people trading, all these people reacting to some negative news or something they read or heard or saw on TV, it's understandable. And that's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why volatility is probably here to stay. So whether it's the fact that it's a presidential election year or bad job news or whatever you believe caused the market retraction in the last week, a lot of people are saying, well, now what do I do? And I would say, again, if this was your long-term money, and it should be, if it wasn't long-term money, it shouldn't have been in the stock market in the first place. If this is your long-term money, you don't need to do anything, and you shouldn't do anything. You shouldn't panic. You shouldn't get out of the market. In fact, it's maybe an opportunity to put more into the market if you have that ability or that discretion. Or if your market contributions are just based on your company retirement plan and your withholdings from your paycheck, you're buying into the market on your next paycheck at a much lower price than you were a week ago. That's a good thing. Buy low, sell high is the cardinal rule of investing. And right now you're buying low or lower than what you recently were. So there's opportunities in these short-term market retractions. There's also opportunities in terms of Roth conversion. Roth conversion, for listeners that don't know, is when I take my traditional IRA and I take a withdrawal and pay the taxes on it, and then I put the proceeds into a Roth IRA where there's no future taxes due. Well, if that account balance just went down, that dollar amount went down because of a market retraction, I can keep those same investments but have them in a Roth IRA, but the tax I'm going to pay now is a little bit less because the account balance is a little bit less. I'm not suggesting that you sell the stocks, get out of the market. When the market's low, I want you to stay invested, but stay invested in a Roth, and the cost of converting to that Roth is less today than it was a week ago. Tax loss harvesting, sometimes on portfolios that we manage for clients that aren't in retirement plans, that are in taxable accounts, we might purposely sell a position to harvest or lock in that loss so we can pass that loss on to the client. And I can already hear you thinking or shouting at your radio or your phone or however you're listening to me right now, you just said not to sell when the market's down. What do you mean you're going to sell? So let's say that we sell position A to harvest a loss. And position A is in large cap domestic stocks. Well, we're going to buy simultaneously position B, which is also in large cap domestic stocks. So we're staying invested. We're staying in the market. We're staying in the same asset class. We're just using a different fund or a different vehicle to have that exposure. But by selling A and locking in that loss and giving you that deduction, that's one of the ways, again, that we enhance tax efficiency and enhance your total return on investment. So these market retractions do give us planning opportunities, whether it's investing more when the market's down, whether it's Roth conversion, whether it's tax loss harvesting, and there's a lot of other things we can do as well. These retractions in the short term never make me nervous. They never bother me. It's okay if it makes you nervous, but again, in terms of strategy or what to do, don't change anything yet if that was long-term money. And then finally, Susie, and I know we want to get listeners involved, I just want to mention this. At times like this, when people are skittish about the market and or they're worried about interest rates and or high inflation, we've just gone through a pretty high inflationary period of time. There are many, many, many people that believe, well, I should just take all my money and go buy gold or some other precious metal. And we believe in diversification. We believe in exposure to precious metals, gold and silver and other precious metals, but not to the extent that you sell all your stocks or cash all your money out of the bank and go buy gold bullion and you know, hide it in your basement safe or put it in a safety deposit box or bury it in your backyard. Look, gold, while we want some exposure, we don't want all of your money there. Gold is a risky investment as well. Many people think gold offers protection against, you know, interest rate risk or stock market retractions or whatever. But, you know, consider this. If you look at the history of gold, in the late 70s and early 80s, gold reached at the time was an all-time high at $850 an ounce. But then gold started to retract, and it actually retracted or went down for almost 20 years, 235 straight months. Gold prices went down till they dropped to the $253 an ounce before they started to go back up again, and then it took another 7 years for it to hit the prices that it hit in January of 1980 of $850. So that was a 27-year period of time. If you bought gold in the beginning of 1980, you didn't get back your value of your investment until the beginning of 2007. Can you imagine how you feel if you ever were underwater in stocks or bonds or other investments for 27 years? So this idea that we rush to gold or precious metals because that's safer is ludicrous. It's just not true. Does that mean I'm against investing in gold? Absolutely not. Gold, silver, other precious metals as a part of a well-diversified portfolio makes absolute sense. But to dump stocks to go put all your money in gold is simply crazy, not a good thing to do. All right, I think that's all I have that I wanted to cover. Susie, let's let listeners drive us the rest of the way.
All right, this texter writes, I enjoy listening to your show. Thank you, thank you. Question is, how does one know how much to convert annually to a traditional Roth IRA conversion? Thank you.
Great question. So let's talk about Roth conversions. And again, for listeners that don't know, that's taking my traditional IRA that has a tax lien on it. I got a deduction for the contribution. I invested with what we call pre-tax dollars. So it saved me taxes the year that I made the contribution. I'm not getting any 1099s on the earnings. So as it grows, I'm not paying any taxes. These are all good things. But when I spend the money, I've got to pay the taxes. And eventually, there's something called a required minimum distribution where I have to take, by law, it's mandated that I take withdrawals from that account whether I want to or not. So as a planning opportunity, again, to try to reduce taxes over a lifetime, maybe not in this tax year, maybe in this tax year you're going to pay more taxes because you're going to take money out of your IRA. And a lot of people say, well, what's the difference? If I'm paying taxes later, I'm paying taxes now, I'm paying taxes either way. But if I shift money to the Roth and I accumulate more where there isn't any tax consequence when I spend it, it gives me another resource of where I can take retirement income. And sometimes I want to spend tax-free money, but sometimes I want to spend money that was tax-deferred that I pay taxes on when I spend it now, and I might want to soak up if I'm in a low tax bracket. So to the texter's question, how do you know how much? It's going to be a function of what is the cost to do it, and then how many years are the cost to do that conversion. So I decide I should do a Roth conversion. How much do I take out of my IRA? We would probably look at what your income is from all other sources and say, how much can we take at this same tax bracket? So, for example, let's say that your income from all your sources of income has you in a 12% federal tax bracket, which is not untypical, by the way. And we determined, well, if you take $10,000 out of your IRA, that'll take you to the top of the 12% bracket, and the next bracket goes to 22%, and we want to avoid that. So we might say, let's convert $10,000 this year, but that doesn't mean we're done converting. Maybe we do $10,000 again next year. We look at it again next year and say, how much can we take out to soak up the bracket that you're in? So it's a little bit more complicated than that, but it starts with how much can I do at a low tax rate? So what is the cost? Now, again, other advantage to converting and getting money over to Roth is we're shrinking our future required minimum distribution. If we have less money in traditional IRA, because Roth is not subjected to required minimum distribution while we are alive, we're shrinking our future tax bill by making that IRA smaller, getting more into the tax-advantaged Roth, and we're doing it at tax-favorable rates. we would not do a Roth conversion if it wasn't tax favorable. So if you're somebody that's working and you're highly compensated and you're in a high tax bracket, you're in a, a 30-some percent tax bracket, and you say, hey, I think I might want to do Roth conversion, we would probably try to talk you out of it, because waiting to take your withdrawals or your distributions from your traditional IRA when you're retired and in a lower tax bracket might actually make a lot more sense. So when to do a conversion, not everybody should do a conversion, but one of the things that we do for all of our clients at standard operating procedure, we look at, does a conversion make sense, yes or no? And if it's yes, how much should we do? How many years should we do it to maximize efficiency? So the texter has a great question. It's a smart question. And I would say, at the risk of seeming like I'm being self-serving or self-promotional, it's probably pretty complicated for most people to figure out that number by themselves. And I strongly encourage getting some guidance from either your financial planner and or your tax preparer to determine what the right number is, or if you should even do it at all.
All right. Susie? Next text question. I will reach full retirement age next month. Can I take my Social Security and still work full time? Will I pay both federal and state taxes on the Social Security amount? Question mark.
Okay, good question. Oh, I love our listeners. These are such good questions. So what a lot of people don't know, first of all, the texter talks about full retirement age. So he's talking, he or she is talking about Social Security, and full retirement age is different for different people based on when you were born. So if you were born 1954 or sooner, your full retirement age is 66. If you were born in 1960 or after, your full retirement age for Social Security is 67. If you were born between 54 and 60, and let's use me as the example because I fit in there, I was born in 1959, so my full retirement age is 66 years and 10 months. If you were born in 1955, it's 66 years and 2 months. So every year, 55, 56, 57, they add 2 months to your full retirement age. Now, why is that important? Well, number one, full retirement age is when you receive what they call full benefits. You can draw Social Security as early as age 62, but you're going to get a diluted benefit. You're going to get considerably less. At age 62, you would only get about 75% of what you would get at full retirement age. From full retirement age until 70, your benefit actually appreciates or grows by about 8% per year. So the age-old question has always been, am I better off to take it sooner and get smaller paychecks but get more of them, or am I better off waiting till later and getting less paychecks but getting more of them? And we can help people determine what the best approach will be for them, but I always say this is never going to be an exact science because we don't know when you're going to die. But we make an assumption of statistically, logically, what age we would expect you statistically to die. And there's a lot of other things that we know about you that we take into consideration as well, like what other assets do you have to create income so you can fund your lifestyle without taking Social Security and so on. But what the texter's asking is, if I hit full retirement age, and again, this is important not only because I achieve what they call full benefits, but if you start to draw Social Security before you reach full retirement age and you're still working and you make too much money. Now, too much money changes a little bit every year. They adjust it for inflation. Right now, I think that figure is just under $20,000. So if I'm not yet reached full retirement age and I'm working and I'm making over 20 grand a year, they actually dilute or diminish my Social Security benefit by like 50 cents on the dollar for everything over that minimum amount of income that I can earn. So in terms of advising clients when to draw Social Security, if they're still working a full-time job or a job where they're working enough that they're making more than $20,000, roughly $20,000 a year, we strongly encourage them not to begin those benefits unless they either stop earning that money or they reach full retirement age. Once you reach full retirement age, you can draw Social Security and make as much as you want with no detrimental impact. You could make $10 million a year, it doesn't matter. It doesn't dilute or diminish your Social Security benefit once you hit full retirement age. Again, either 66, 67, or 66 years in some months. And then finally, the texter also asked, do you have to pay state and federal taxes on it? This comes as a shock, Susie, to a lot of people that have not yet reached retirement age and are not yet drawing Social Security. But Social Security income is taxable. At the federal level. Whether it's taxable or not at the state level depends upon what state that you live in. There are 12 states that tax your Social Security benefit. I live in Minnesota. This show originates in Minnesota, and Minnesota is one of the 12 states that we do pay taxes on our Social Security benefit. Both political parties have said they want to change that and they want to get rid of it, but they haven't done it yet. The talk is cheap. I'll believe it when it happens. So, yes, when you draw Social Security, you're going to pay taxes on it, at least at the federal level, no matter where you live. Now, this is another planning opportunity. Are there ways that we can reduce those taxes on your Social Security? And the answer is, oftentimes, yes, with proper planning. The amount of tax you pay on your Social Security is going to be determined by your total income, and they include a lot of things in there, including some things that you don't think they probably should, including 50% of your Social Security benefit. And so your Social Security is either going to be taxed at 50% rate or an 85% rate, and that doesn't mean 85% in taxes. In other words, if my Social Security benefit is $1,000 a month, I'm either going to pay taxes on 500 of that or 850 of that 1,000 at whatever my tax rate is. Might be 10% or 12% federal tax rate. So it might be 12% of 850. But we might be able to shrink that number with planning. So I know that was a long-winded answer, but the question really has a lot of different avenues and a lot of different things that I wanted to address to give a thorough answer. So yes, Social Security benefits are taxable. There's things we can do to try to mitigate some of that tax. We probably can't eliminate it or make it go away completely. And whether or not it's taxed in your state depends upon the state you live in. I don't remember what all 12 of the states are, but 12 states also charge state tax on your Social Security benefit. And Susie, I know I talked long enough that I probably eliminated any chance to get in any more questions today. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just going to ask if you wanted to get one more in, but we're under a minute, so maybe we should just wrap it up and remind people if they're listening and they did not get their question answered, and there are a fair number of people that do have questions. Some of them, Bruce, too, are a little involved as well in terms of, you know, specific questions about what to take out and when, etc. So you can always email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or you can always call your office right at 1-888-6-ADVICE, 1-888-6-ADVICE. Someone will call you back, leave a message, they'll get back to you. Bruce, make it a great week. A lot of good information today. Hope you have a wonderful day.
You as well, Susie. Thank you.
All right. And the time is 8:56.